Thank you. Be seated.
Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Dawson Austin versus Austin.
May it please the court, Mr. David Evans will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'm accompanied today by Mr. Michelle, Thomas Michelle of my law firm, who has been a part of this appeal and would like to give a lot of credit to for all the hard work that's been done. This, of course, is an appeal from the divorce case, which was tried in Dallas County. The parties were married in Minnesota in the year 1980, established their marital residence there, and became involved in a corporation which the husband had owned prior to marriage, known as Starkey Laboratories, whose principal place of business is in Minnesota. After several years of cohabitating in...
Mr. President, did you say they were married in Minnesota?
Yes, sir.
I thought they were married in China.
I may have misspoken. Their marital residence was established, and their first marital residence was in Minnesota.
Marriage was in China.
Sir?
Marriage was in China. You said marriage was in Minnesota.
I misspoke, Your Honor. The parties resided in Minnesota, and that was their first marital residence. After a few years, the wife took up residence in their other residence, which was located in California. Wife eventually filed for divorce in the state of California, but did not have her husband serve the petition. Immediately following the filing of the divorce case in California, husband moved to Dallas, Texas. And 6 months to the day following his move to Dallas, Texas, husband filed a petition for divorce in the 301st Judicial District Court of Dallas, Texas. Husband's pleadings alleged no long-arm jurisdictional facts. Husband admitted in his pleadings that wife was a resident of California. Wife responded to this pleading and service with a pleading entitled Special Appearance, Motion to Quash, Plea and Abatement, all subject to the above original answer, is the official long-winded title. It is interesting to note that on the very first page, and I believe it will be part of the demonstrative aid that Mr. Orsinger has brought for you today, that wife states that she objects to in personam jurisdiction. The wife says that the motion is filed prior to a motion to transfer or any other plea or pending motion, that she is not amenable to process. She swears on the second page that she is not a resident, nor has she ever had, or nor was the last place of their marital residence ever in the state of Texas. That she then goes on to deny, especially deny, or state specifically, that she's never done business in Texas or committed any tort.
Her special appearance is only as to part of the action.
Her special appearance is in accordance with the holdings in Hoffman versus Hoffman, Fox versus Fox, and the Supreme Court cases of Esten and Williams versus North Carolina, is a pleading that she is amenable as that the rim, the issue of the divorce, is subject to jurisdiction, but that her property and her personal obligations are not subject to the in personam jurisdiction of this state. Probably one of the leading texts in this authority on this issue is authored by Mr. Orsinger at section 20.6 of Texas Family Law Service. He writes that Texas courts in this situation recognize the visible divorce and then makes a statement, or he is a practice consultant. Maybe they have a different situation. I don't want to misstate whether he's author or just merely practice consultant to that section. And then he states, otherwise, Texas does not recognize separable divorce. But that is correct.
Would you say again what her special appearance means in the paragraph 2?
In paragraph 2, the demonstrative they used, that I believe that Mr. Orsinger has brought to the court today, would have a copy of it present. Paragraph number 1, she makes the paragraph number 2, this special appearance is made to the several claim asserted by Bill, wherein Bill seeks a division of the party's property. That is Roman numeral 2.
The property that's at issue is separate property, is that correct?
It is, yes, ma'am. It is property acquired prior to marriage. Non-marital property, if you use the terminology of common law state.
Well, no, but
Does that then mean that she objects only to the property division by special appearance? Does not then object to appearing as to her person in personam?
I would not read that way because of the first paragraph.
Why did she say it?
Well, because the reason I wouldn't read it that way is because in Roman number 1.
Well, I read that too, but why would she say what she says in 2 if she's going to limit it? Why not just not have 2?
I think that the method of practice that is developed in the courts recognizes the concept of severable, divisible divorce in these situations, Your Honor.
If they do that, then doesn't the law vis-a-vis special appearances say that if you appear for a limited purpose, that you're there otherwise for all other purposes?
Yes, sir, and I think the other purpose would be as to the rent, the status of divorce.
All right, so it's the conclusion that she is there in personam.
I didn't reach that conclusion. No, sir. I reached the conclusion.
Well, she wasn't disputing the right to have a divorce granted.
That's correct.
So if the court could enter an order granting a divorce, can they do it without her being served, waiver service, or waive special appearance?
They can do it without in personam jurisdiction.
But she has to have something happen to her, is that right?
Sir?
She has to have something happen to her to get her before the court.
That's correct, but the assertion of that jurisdiction, as I understand it under the Supreme Court of the United States cases, is that divorce is a matter of status. It's an issue of quasi in rem assertion of jurisdiction and not an assertion of in personam jurisdiction.
But without some appearance of hers, you just can't grant divorces to people who are not before the court.
Without some service of her, would be my only qualification.
By servant, by waiver of service, or waiver of a special appearance. Because she's there with her lawyer in this lawsuit. She goes forward with the divorce part.
That's correct. I would only say that I don't think a special appearance as a status, as a divisional status, would be well taken, since it's pretty clear that that the fact that you're not a resident will not prevent the court from granting the divorce. It's only if the issues of property and personal obligations. The pleading, which was, and I think the issue that we believe exists is whether or not federal law on the doctrine of severable divorce preempts the state law, which holds that it is generally an abuse of discretion is impermissible to sever property from status at the trial court level. But as everyone also knows, and as Mr. has written in the Texas Family Law Service, it is always done on appeal that the divorce is confirmed, but the case is remanded back for property division. So we do recognize several divorce, at least at the appellate stage, and I think that the true rule in the state is it is generally an abuse of discretion to sever property from the status of the marriage. And in our situation, we believe that the federal law would preempt, and that the cases in Texas are several which submit to this. In Fox versus Fox, and I refer that to the court decided by both parties, the wife filed just the same special appearance that was filed in this case. Wherein she filed and said, I don't object to Texas granting the divorce. I object to any exercise over my person or my property as to my personal obligations between my husband or the division of divorce.
I want to make sure I understand your argument. You're saying that the Texas trial courts don't have jurisdiction over the separate property sought. They can't make an award of that in a divorce action in Texas. Is that what you're saying here?
They would not have jurisdiction.
They don't have jurisdiction.
Over her personal, over in personam jurisdiction, determine her rights with regard to the enhancement of that stock, which is a particular issue in this case. Yes.
And the husband has never lived in California, so he could make the same argument in the California court, I take it.
That's correct.
There's no in rem jurisdiction.
Well, go ahead, I'm sorry.
So, and neither of the parties now reside in Minnesota, and there's no divorce pending in Minnesota. What court does have jurisdiction?
First off, the party, there is no basis for the husband to object to the assertion of California jurisdiction, and there has, and California does have jurisdiction in this case over the husband. That was a residence which each of them bought together.
I'm talking about the stock.
The stock, yes, ma'am. Well, the stock would go with the parties where their marital residence was, or with the state that would have the most significant contact with it under conflicts of law choice.
Mr. Evans, if the residence is owned by him, aren't you still talking about MRAM as opposed to personal jurisdiction? I mean, he would not, because he owns property there, California could dispose of the property there without him having personal jurisdiction, being subject to personal jurisdiction, right?
It would be determined on Bill Austin's contacts with the state of California, whether they're systematic and continuous, whether that was a place of marital residence or not, whether they had activities there where they had dual residency in Minnesota and in Texas.
But if the stock were located here in Texas, the shares were located here in Texas, then Texas would have jurisdiction of that NRAM as property, regardless of whether she was ever in Texas or not.
I think I disagree. Schaefer versus Heitner decides that, I think, pretty decisively, that the situs of the stock does not determine in personam rights with regard to the obligations concerning the stock. And here's the point. What this case really grows out of is the combined efforts of the parties which enhance the separate property. And that is probably a personal obligation between the parties, although it has a nexus to that piece of, to that certificate of stock. It has a nexus to that company. It arises out of their marital relationship and their obligations to each other, their duties of using their community time, toil, and effort for each other. And so the certificate is an evidence of ownership. And its situs could be moved to anywhere, but it would not affect where the parties lived and how they and what they did together that contributed to the enhancement of it. It's what we're deciding in this case is Mrs. Austin's, what we will call a right, what we call in Texas, right of reimbursement. What she is entitled to for this dramatic increase in value of the stock. And so title...
But again, the court in Texas, regardless of where she lives, could decide the title of the stock. They could decide who has title of this stock.
Most commentators, and in fact, Richard's article at 20.6 would disagree that that's probably inappropriate at this point and is constitutionally infirm in that regard because of the fact that the growth of procedural safeguards with Schaefer versus Heitner being the primary lead case on would indicate that what you're doing is you're deciding wife's rights with regard to a piece of property and her ability perhaps to execute upon it if that were permitted in this state, which it is not on separate property, but her rights that are affected and have some nexus with that stock. So it is a, it's a very complex question. I don't want to digress. I want to see the green light.
Wouldn't the rule be different if it was realty? I mean, how can you own realty in a state and not submit this jurisdiction?
Well, you hit upon a very significant facet of this case.
But first, stock may not even be issued. Who knows what it is?
And it may be transferred in Delaware. It may be transferred on a corporate stock book in New York City. And you're right about realty. The facts of this case and its application, especially with conflicts, are very limited because in most circumstances, 99% of it, the parties are going to move to Texas together. They're going to establish a marital residence, which is going to be sufficient basis for jurisdiction and determination of property
but
rights.
What I'm trying to get is just the legal theory of where we go with Schaefer versus Heitner. Let's just assume that you could not get in rim jurisdiction over the husband in California. You can't get in rim, we would agree with you, you can't get in rim jurisdiction over the wife in Texas. Who does have the jurisdiction to decide this enhancement of the stock value? Who has the jurisdiction to make a disposition of that property if the party's no longer living in Minnesota?
And the facts you've given me is that assume that there is no jurisdiction over husband in California?
Correct. Just as you're arguing there's no jurisdiction of the wife in Texas, assume that the same would be true in California.
Well, I will accept the assumption, although that's not a fact in the case. Then it would be to the last place of marital residence, which would be Minnesota, would be my belief.
Where do we look for the law that tells us that it would be Minnesota?
Well, I think that we look at cases like Williams versus North Carolina, Esten versus Esten, Schaefer versus Heitner. The Hoffman versus Hoffman is a case decided by the Fort Worth Court of Appeals. Fox versus Fox is a case decided by the Fort Worth Court. As I recall, the Dallas Court of Appeals has had more than one case involving the assertion of impersonal jurisdiction with regard to child support obligations, and whether or not you can determine the status of a child because the child's present in the past, but you have certain other prohibitions about establishing personal obligations with regard to the children.
So one of the parties would have to go back to Minnesota and file a third proceeding to get this specific asset divided up?
If you're correct that California has no jurisdiction.
Why couldn't she sue him in Texas?
Sir?
Why couldn't she sue him in Texas?
She could.
And why couldn't he sue her in California?
He could. I mean, any party can come in and take care of jurisdiction.
I'm ready to questions. Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the sponsor.
May it please the court, Mr. Richard Orsinger will present argument from the
Members of the court, I'm hearing on behalf of the respondent to urge the court that the Court of Appeals opinion should be affirmed or that you should dismiss the writ as improvidently granted. And I wanted initially to give the court an overview of our petition on the three main areas in which you granted writ. One is the special appearance, one is discovery, and one is the conflict of laws question. It's our view that there was a faulty special appearance because it was not verified and there was no proof offered at the special appearance hearing, and that constitutes a waiver of jurisdiction. Also,
what about their argument that the petition had no jurisdictional, that's your argument, no jurisdictional facts, so that they waived it for that reason? All you had to do is say, I'm a non-resident?
Your Honor, there is no case law in Texas that says that an allegation that the defendant is a non-resident concedes that there is no minimum contacts or no personal jurisdiction.
But your position, there's no evidence in the record, so what does the court look at to decide whether she's there or not?
Ordinarily, the court would look at the pleadings, such as the verified special appearance and the supporting affidavits and the deposition testimony and the sworn testimony presented at the hearing on special appearance. We had none of those. She didn't verify her special appearance. Her affidavit that was attached, which is in the handout that I gave to the court, although it says it's under the penalties of perjury, if you look at the jurat, there is no jurat. It was just an acknowledgement before a notary that it had been executed. There was
what
no oath.
The statute control over the rule?
The statute, you mean the family code statute requiring that an answer, saying that an answer need not be under oath? We believe, Your Honor, that statute, which goes back before the day that the special appearance rule even existed in Texas, relates to the necessity of filing a sworn denial on the merits, and that the mere failure to file an answer, sworn or not, does not permit a default on the divorce. You still have to prove the divorce on evidence.
I assume when 128 was passed, this statute was not listed by the court, not sent by the court to the legislature as a statute that was being modified.
No, it was not. And this, to my knowledge, this is the first time it's ever been suggested by anyone anywhere that somehow the requirement of swearing to a special appearance or plea and abatement or any other of the normal pleas that are required to be under oath is somehow obviated by the family code. It can be amended. And the Rule 128 says it can be amended. But
Ms. Dawson Austin have a chance to amend it?
Well, she did have a chance to amend it, but what she chose to do was to have a hearing on the special appearance. She requested a continuance to do discovery. It was denied. They proceeded to a hearing on the special appearance. It was denied. Then Ms. Austin went forward with her attack on the service, her attack on the subject matter jurisdiction, and her attack on a plea and abatement to a prior pending California proceeding. Did she amend.
What were her alternatives at the point where the court says you didn't verify your special appearance, and so I'm overruling that?
She should have asked the court, say, Your Honor, under Rule 120A, I'm permitted to request the opportunity to amend, and I make that request. And she should not have invoked the general jurisdictional authority of the court to rule on her alternative relief if she wanted to keep the issue open of her special appearance. What she did was she moved on.
Why isn't that a gotcha?
Well, it's not a gotcha because it's written right in the rule how you're supposed to file a special appearance, and then after a while we put the safeguard in that if you have made the mistake that other lawyers made that you didn't verify it, request the opportunity to amend.
On the larger issue, or one of the larger issues, Mr. Corsair, assuming hypothetically people who are residing in another state, that one of the spouses moves to Texas for the sole reason of taking advantage of Texas's marital property laws and brings the stock certificates of the business with him, and that's the only contact with Texas. Is that a good idea for Texas to encourage people to do that sort of thing by holding, by this court or any other court holding, that you thereby establish the state with the most significant contacts in terms of determining what the marital state is and how it ought to be divided?
I agree that constitutes forum shopping, but it's no more forum shopping than moving from Minnesota to California and filing a divorce, and it's no more forum shopping than trying to bring the divorce law of Minnesota into Texas. However, that's not what happened in this case, and the court did not find that happened in this case. The corporation that the husband owned has two factories located in the state of Texas. They have land in New Jersey, Florida, Oregon, California, Texas, Minnesota. They were married in China. Justice Gonzalez was correct on that. This is a multi-state, even multinational couple. They have property everywhere. They have a business that has business in a lot of different states. And there is no indication, no finding, or not even any evidence that the husband was motivated solely by forum shopping to come to Texas.
I know you are arguing on the facts of this case that this is not the case that I ask you to hypothesize, but in the hypothetical case, is there nothing that a court or litigants can do to avoid that kind of forum shopping, blatant forum shopping, necessarily to get an advantage in the divorce proceeding?
What I would suggest is that the jurisdictional rules themselves contain the necessary protection. If a party comes to a state and files for a divorce, we all know that they can get the dissolution of marital bonds based on domicile alone. It is also my view, contrary to what Mr. Evans attributed to the written materials, that whatever state the divorce is in also has the authority to adjudicate property that's located in that state, whether
Why?
It's real or personal. Pardon me, Your Honor?
Why?
Why
if it's personal?
Because it's long been recognized that it is proper for a state to exercise jurisdiction over the real property and the personal property that's located in the state. And in the handout that I gave to the court, I included copies of Restatement Section 60 and 64, Restatement of Conflicts, and 60 says a state has the power to exercise judicial jurisdiction to affect interest in a chattel in the state, which is not merely in transit. 64, subsection 2 says, a state has power to exercise judicial jurisdiction to affect interest in a share certificate which is within its territory.
So if I and my business partner have a dispute over who owns our IBM stock, I can go to a state neither one of us have ever been in, plunk down the stock certificates, and ask for an adjudication.
Well, I believe that situation, I'm not prepared to say that the court is required to extend jurisdiction then if the stock is only there for purposes of the lawsuit. I think that perhaps that's comprehended by the idea that it's in transit.
Well, what if I say, okay, I'm going to move here, live here, stay here forever, and now I want you to say, even though the defendant, my business partner, has no contact with the state, whatever.
I think under the recognized doctrines of jurisprudence that have existed over 100 years, that's perfectly permissible. I would also say it's permissible as a matter of constitutional law under Schaefer versus Heitner, but I also want to point out the subsequent cases of the U.S. Supreme Court of Vernon versus the Superior Court of California. Let me speak briefly about...
Of course, in the family code, it presupposes that you have to be here for 6 months.
Yes, you have to be a domiciliary.
There are some protections there for porn shopping.
Absolutely. You'd have to live here as your domicile for 6 months before you can even bring a divorce proceeding. So that would ameliorate a situation where someone came here and tried to file a suit first, maybe a week or two after they came. Now, as a matter of constitutional law, in Schaefer versus Heitner, which Mr. Evans referred to, there was a statute in Delaware saying that all owners of stock were deemed to have their stock located in Delaware, and because the stock was located in Delaware, it was the situs of the stock, they could exercise jurisdiction over the non-resident owners based on this legal fiction that their stock was in Delaware. The Supreme Court of the United States says we will not accept that fiction in this lawsuit where your lawsuit is not over the stock. You're not suing over the stock, you're suing over some unrelated activity, and you're saying because fictionally their stock is located in Delaware, we therefore have jurisdiction. But even in Justice Marshall's opinion, he says, when the claims to the property itself are the source of the underlying controversy between the plaintiff and the defendant, it would be unusual for the state where the property is located not to have jurisdiction. Now, mind you, the difference is Schaefer versus Heitner was unrelated, litigation unrelated to the ownership of the stock. In our situation, ownership of the stock and the rights relative to being married to the owner of the stock were the core of the issue. Goes on to say further, and this is Justice Marshall saying about the effect of Schaefer versus Heitner, it appears therefore that jurisdiction over many types of actions which now are or might be brought in rem would not be affected by holding that any assertion of state court jurisdiction must satisfy the international shoe standard. In other words, even in Schaefer versus Heitner, Justice Marshall was saying, we're probably not going to affect the import of litigation of property located inside the state. But let me go on, because the Supreme Court in Burnham versus Superior Court of California in 1990 took several giant steps back from the Schaefer versus Heitner case. And in that case, in the lead opinion written by Justice Scalia, he says, it goes too far to say, as petitioner contends, that Schaefer compels the conclusion that a state lacks jurisdiction over an individual unless the litigation arises out of his activities in the state. Schaefer, like International Shoe, involved jurisdiction over an absent defendant, and it stands for nothing more than the proposition that when the minimum contact that is a substitute for physical presence consists of property ownership, it must, like other minimum contacts, be related to the litigation. So what the Berman case says is that if you're going to assert jurisdiction based on the location of property within the state, it has to be a lawsuit relating to that asset, not a lawsuit relating to some other event, and aha, we found an asset here, so we can litigate the other event because you have an asset here. But under Burnham, under Scalia's opinion, if you're litigating the rights in the property, that's okay. And on the next page he says, it is fair to say, however, that while our holding today does not contradict Schaefer, our basic approach to the due process question is different. In other words, let's not stop with the analysis on Schaefer, although I think we win on it. Let's look at the Burnham case, because in the Burnham case they said, if your litigation is based on interest in the asset that is located in your state, that comports with due process. It's also important to recognize that the standard in International Shoe has to do with fairness and historicity of the exercise of jurisdiction. Does it comport with our notions of fair play that have existed over the years of our jurisprudence? And as I've demonstrated in the restatement of conflicts, yes, the exercise of jurisdiction over property in the state is part of our judicial tradition. It does comport with our traditional notions of fair play and due course. And additionally, we have a specific restatement on litigating rights in shares of stock.
What are the fairness factors that militate in your client's favor?
In my client's favor, he is the sole owner of these shares of stock. And it would seem reasonable that wherever he lives, that court of that state would have the authority to adjudicate his ownership rights.
But if he was still in Minnesota with those shares of stock, there would be a different division.
There would have been no divorce in Texas to begin with. But yes, if he was in Minnesota, the Minnesota Divorce Court has different authority from the Texas Divorce Court. So if a divorce had been brought in Minnesota, for example, that court has the power to take separate property under certain circumstances, and also, in violation of our tradition, the increase in value of separate property stock attributable to labor is considered marital and divisible rather than inviolate and separate. And that would violate our rule of Jensen and the Bologna.
But that's a separate issue. What law applies?
Yes, that's the conflict issue, and I want to jump
even ahead. If you've got jurisdiction, whether you've got jurisdiction in Texas or not, Minnesota law may apply.
Well,
or not.
Yes, and we say or not is very important because this court has already said or not, and the legislature has already said or not. What happened in the case of Cameron versus Cameron, there was an issue about whether bonds that were purchased with money earned in common law jurisdictions was community or separate and divisible when it came to Texas. Now, what happened was the legislature adopted 3.63B of the Family Code. And in 3.63B, they said, we are not going to evaluate all these contacts with all these jurisdictions that people have lived in. If you get divorced in Texas, you apply our divorce law. What would have been community is divisible. What would have been separate is not divisible. And that was legislatively enacted, but only for cases that were filed after the effective date of the statute. This court was squarely presented with a similar situation, but a case that was filed before the effective date of the statute, and therefore the statute did not control. And in Cameron versus Cameron, this court said, we are not going to adopt the cumbersome conflict of law approach. We are going to adopt the policy of 3.63B as the common law of our state. This is rational and this is better. So if you will, that makes divorce cases different from contract cases and tort cases.
Why? Because the legislature can pass a statute in contracts that says no matter where the contract arose and what other rules might apply, if they sue in Texas, Texas law applies.
They could do that. Now, in this situation, what happened, Your Honor, was the contention was, are the rights and property brought to Texas when the couples migrate here, and do we have to look at the law of former jurisdictions to find out what power the court has over it? And what the legislature said, which several of the states had done, is to say, well, if they live so many years in such and such a state and so many years in such and such a state, well, their retirement benefits are two-fifths under the law of this state and three-fifths under the law of this state. And they said, this is too complicated. We need to try a divorce case in Texas based on law we're all familiar with. So they passed a statute saying that if you have a divorce in Texas, we're going to apply our distinction to separate and community. And the court adopted that in Cameron as a matter of common law. Now, that distinguishes
it from court contract. It looks like you could abolish all the law of conflicts and 50 states would agree to pass a law that says no matter what, our state law governs.
Yes, but there are special considerations in the family law arena. There are special compensations made. For example, minimum contacts now is widely recognized by every legislature in the U.S. Congress. You don't have to have minimum contacts to adjudicate custody and visitation. There was a time when people thought you did. The U.S. Supreme Court truly has never spoken to that issue, but every single state legislature in the U.S. Congress has agreed that that's not required. Even in Schaefer versus Heitner, there's a footnote saying that status adjudications have a separate rule, and we're not saying that our minimum contacts analysis is going to affect those status adjudications. Now, we believe, Your Honor, that the Cameron case has already ruled that you do not borrow the law of other states, and that the legislature has said you do not borrow the law of other states to divide property in Texas. It is very important, by the way, to maintain the distinction, which is ignored, I believe, in Petitioner's brief. We are not talking about ownership rights. We're not talking about rights that the wife had in the stock before she came to Texas because she was an owner. She has no ownership rights. This is entirely his separate property, and under Egemeyer versus Egemeyer, a Texas court cannot take it away from him. So, we already have a Supreme Court ruling, a statute that says that Texas law should be applied.
But the increase may be community.
The increase is not community under Ballone and Jensen. You have a right to reimbursement for undercompensation, but you do not have an ownership right, and that was decided in Ballone and carried forward in Jensen.
So now, the bottom line is the court's binding on the undercompensation issue.
That is the claim that the wife has in this situation. That is the claim that she has. It's a reimbursement claim, and she has.
Do you agree with that?
What, that she has?
That it's all a reimbursement claim.
Yes. Mr. Evans said that they're not asserting an ownership right, and if that's true, then I don't know why they're trying to bring Minnesota law in, because the essential difference between Minnesota law and Texas law is a right to ownership instead of a right to reimbursement. So, to us, to say that this is a reimbursement case is to say that, in fact, Texas law applies. Now, I'm limited in my time, and I do want to address the discovery issue simply because there seem to be so many differences of opinion at the Court of Appeals level. In this situation, we had interrogatories that were filed on the 30th day before trial declaring that two consulting experts were now going to be trial experts. It was disclosed in January. The case went to trial on July 1. It was disclosed in interrogatories in January that the wife had hired experts, that they were consulting experts. But in those same answers to interrogatories, the wife said, all of our consulting experts are going to be testifying experts. So as long as January she had made the decision that they were going to testify, she said, I don't have their opinion, so I'm not going to disclose them. On the 29th or 30th day before trial, depending on how you calculate it, because even her lawyer in the trial court said it was 29 days. She uncloaked these witnesses and said they're now going to be testifying experts. But the wife did not sign the answers to interrogatories, and she did not verify them. And in fact, if you read the answers to interrogatories, you'll find, and look at the good cause hearing, that the lawyer was not even in touch with the wife. He had sent the interrogatories to her. She had not responded to him. And so at the very last minute, he signed the interrogatories himself and filed them.
As a practical matter, how can a party verify a designation or disclosure in interest interrogatories that it's true and correct? The party, I mean, the party doesn't know who the lawyer will call. The party doesn't know what the experts will testify to necessarily. Why is a verification meaningful when you're dealing with expert witnesses?
Well, the most important reason why verification should be required for supplementation is that if you don't require verification for a supplemental answer to interrogatory, you eviscerate the sworn interrogatory practice. Because what will happen is that the original interrogatories that have to be under oath will now be, I don't have enough information to answer this. And then you will start getting your supplemental answers, none of which are sworn. And so what will happen is that by creating this exception, the supplemental answers to interrogatories do not have to be sworn. The exception will swallow the rule.
What about experts specifically?
Now, if we talk about experts specifically, you do know whether or not an expert has been contacted and arranged to have them testify. You can swear to that under oath. If you have interviewed with them or if you have seen
them... The lawyer may not.
That's true. But the party is responsible for the knowledge of all of their agents. And the verification is important in this situation, and even the signing is important in this situation, because the lawyer who filed these answers to interrogatories had been filed in April. He filed the supplemental answers in June. His client did not authorize the filing of the supplemental answers. And so we're going to trial in a case in which the client could say, she had eight lawyers in different states. She could say, I didn't authorize the filing of that interrogatory. I don't consider myself responsible. I didn't sign it. I didn't swear to it. And he had no authority to do it. And furthermore, the interrogatory answers do not say what the witness's opinion is. If you read them, and they're in this handout that I gave to the court, they say that it's the lawyer's belief that the value is so much or the claim is so much. They never once disclose what the experts themselves will testify to.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Evans, what was your client's expectation that Minnesota law would apply to the Division of Marital Estate in this case? What reasonable expectation did she have?
I think if you apply the restatement number 6 to section number 6 of this, the reasonable expectation would have been is that their first marital residence was established in Minnesota. I believe that it's a fair inference from the testimony that was the last location in which they resided together. Now, they both continued to work for the company right up until the time of the divorce was filed. They were both participants in the company, although there's no doubt that the time, toil, and effort of Mr. Austin was significantly more important to the profit to that. But she had absolutely no expectation that Texas law would apply. The one thing I'd like to correct is that there is proof in this record of non-residency. At the statement of facts, page 37 and 38, on the November 10th hearing, the following occurred.
Is that the first or second hearing?
November the 10th or 11th, and it's unclear from the record which it is, Your Honor, and I've tried to do that and can't. It is the statement of facts, pages 30, beginning at the bottom of 37, going over into 38. Mr. Raggio, having no witnesses, having been ordered to proceed on his special appearance, which was not set by him, but the special appearance, motion to quash, motion to plea and abatement were all set by opposing counsel. And thus he was faced with a Hobson choice, I think, that may have been alluded to earlier. He tenders, at this point, the pleading signed by Cindy Austin Dawson. Now, she signed that as a pro se party under Rule 13, which is at least a certification that she's investigated the facts, and it's not barred for bad for purposes of bad faith. She has three sworn declarant statements there to it that she was served in her home in California. And she has attached to it her petition for divorce in California, which is signed by her under penalty of perjury, that she is a resident of California.
Well, she's been dormant for over 6 months.
dormant if you consider negotiations and attempt to reach an amicable settlement dormancy, Your Honor.
No, sir, with no service.
I do not dispute that. That's correct. A mediated result is much better than 4 years of litigation. But the point is, when it was tendered by Kenneth Raggio, this pleading, Respondents Exhibit Number 1, and the petition that is under consideration, Mr. Tindall, counsel for Mr. Austin, said, I join the tender. It was a joint tendered exhibit. It was admitted without objection, and thus under Rule 802, any hearsay contained in with it was probative of the facts asserted to include the jurisdictional facts which are on the first and second page. So there is evidence in the record. What about the request for recess? On page 41 and 42, it suddenly becomes apparent to Mr. Raggio that there is this defect in the jury, that the clip and paste of the title of the pleading is going to cause him great problems. He suggests a recess, and as you follow it, you realize the trial court says, what good would that do? An unsworn appearance is a general appearance and overrules his request for recess. So it does appear in the record. Supplemental interrogatories, interest of justice, Trans-America, and a few other large issues that may loom out here as a result of the granting of this writ. I'd like to just address it. Six courts of appeals, at least, have held that you do not have to verify interrogatories, supplemental answers to interrogatories. Prior to, in the old rule, and prior to the form of the new rule, there was a case out there that said detective verification was not fatal. If this court decides that you have to swear to supplemental answers and you can't verify, it's going to play over into depositions. How would you supplement a deposition? Would you re-notice a client's deposition? Will it apply to defective jurats, an acknowledgement instead of a sworn statement? What if the notary doesn't have a certificate? The point is to get the information out there. Jones versus Kidder was cited in 90.
Your time is expired.
Thank you.
That's your answer to the question.
Appreciate it.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the third cause. The court will now take a brief lunch recess until 2 o'clock.
All right.